Please. Well, thanks for the opportunity to be here. It's great. Let me give you a little menu of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to first just start with an overview, which is just kind of designed to give you just the basic idea very quickly, so you know where I'm headed with this. Then I'm going to give you a little bit of chemistry, which is going to be a bit more detailed about how this magnetic bubble chamber kind of works and why it works. Let me put that in quotes because I don't know much about chemistry. Then I'm going to talk about using these more as the detector principle. So just more details of what I'm going to give in the overview of how you can use these things as a particle detector. And then I'm going to show a few slides which give some details on ongoing experimental progress. Like a prototype. All right. So let's start with the overview. So the idea is that this is going to be a particle detector that's sensitive to energy deposits that are in somewhere in the range of like a milli electron volt to an electron volt. Energy deposits. And this is kind of interesting from like a dark matter point of view. So this puts you in the region. So if you're thinking about detecting dark matter masses, energies, which can range from something like 10 to the minus 23 electron volts. Let me write 10 to the minus 4-ish electron volts. Then sort of an electron volt. And then above, up to GeV, kind of dark matter masses. This is like mass or energy or whatever. So here, in this kind of regime, you have a kind of wimpy scattering experiments that can typically do, they can go down to energies, certainly no more at the moment than below an EV. Certainly, you have an ionization threshold around here, so anything that requires ionization, you won't be sensitive to because the energy is just not enough. You cannot detect that energy. And here, there's the kind of more coherence type experiments that I guess are more sensitivity frontier. And these start to cut off at around 10 to the minus 4 EV, where you start to lose coherence and you start to lose sensitivity there. So there's this kind of interesting window here, which is exactly the sort of milli EV to an EV range. And this is the kind of region that, from the dark matter point of view, we'll be potentially probing. So this is dark matter masses of something like 10 MeV down to a keV. So this is dark matter. And while there's not so much, I guess, not as much theoretical motivation as, say, the WIMP or like an axion, I think like it's, if you have the opportunity to explore new parameter space and a lot of parameter space quickly and potentially cheaply, then it's a worthwhile thing to do. But like
that's capital. That's mega EV.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, loopy handwriting. Yeah, thank you. Although if it's a dark photon, then it could be a MeV mass. It gets absorbed, and it could be a milli EV mass. This is just in general. This is a new energy regime for a particle detector. So as well as dark matter, you could be detecting, say, lower energy neutrinos or photons, either low energy photons or photons that deposit very little energy with a very forward scatter or something. So this is a new energy regime, so that's always kind of exciting. So let me now give the disclaimer, is that I'm a theorist. And so as I've been giving more and more, visiting more and more of these kind of conferences and speaking to more and more experimentalists, I get more and more nervous giving this talk, actually. And so when I say things like, cool this to 0.1 Tesla and, measure this tiny magnetic field, I am aware that these are very difficult things to do. I don't want it to sound like I'm just a theorist saying, silly stuff. And I am aware that there are backgrounds and noise and dark counts and all this kind of stuff. But, having said that now, this is my disclaimer. Now I'm going to probably just, say things as if I'm not aware of them. But I should say my collaborators. So although I'm not an experimentalist, I do have collaborators who are experimentalists. So let me give their names. Giorgio Grattan. is Ajit Bajendran. So, theorist, experimentalist, and this guy is a chemist. So we had a paper out in, actually I don't have the archive number, but in 2015, we had a paper, late 2015, we had a paper on this. Or 2016, I think, I can't remember now. 2017. What year is it? 17. Yes. 2018 at the moment, right, yeah. And since then, the Texas A&M, Rupak Patra, Hao Chan, who's a postdoc, and Michael. So experimentalist and chemist, they have been building, starting to build this prototype. Is it getting a bit messy? I'll slow down my writing. Okay. And so I think when we wrote this paper, there were two things. So one, if you want to detect these kind of energies in the particle detector, you first got to show that at least in principle you can be sensitive to it. And that's, I think, what we're claiming. So first you show you're in principle sensitive, and then after that, then you can start thinking about in practice. So I'm going to talk about this in principle sensitive, and then I'll show a few of the, I'll show some slides at the end, which give a few photos of the in practice part of this idea. Okay, so what is the idea? This is an extremely small energy deposit, and so this kind of suggests investigating systems with an intrinsic energy gain. So you have this kind of cartoon here. So this is your system. Your system gets put in some state. This is energy up here. And this state is a metastable state. There's a little activation barrier here. So it's metastable because there's this activation barrier. But if you put in a little bit of energy, you get over the activation barrier and you can sort of, the system can relax. So you relax here into the stable state. And then, of course, when you do this, you release this energy, the energy difference between the metastable state and the true stable state. And then this released energy can form a sort of positive feedback loop, and you get some sort of avalanche. And this is exactly what happens in a conventional bubble chamber. So you decompress your fluid, so you sit at a supercritical point, a particle comes in, deposits a little bits of energy, this puts the liquid into a gaseous phase, and so then that releases the energy, and the little bubble of gas expands and expands and expands because it keeps releasing more and more energy in this kind of avalanche process. And then what you do is these bubbles then become big enough so the thing has been amplified. This is the amplification process, this positive feedback thing. So then you can actually see the bubbles, and you've amplified a small signal into a measurable signal. And so, just like a bubble chamber, you know, ideally this doesn't destroy. This doesn't destroy the detector. There are many examples of sort of feedback loops or avalanches which, you know, explode. You know, dynamite is an example of this. It would just explode, and then you use it once and you can't use it again. The nice thing about the bubble chamber is that you just you compress and then decompress again, and you start from start. So you have this nice reset. So you want a reset mechanism. And I guess I'm going to try and keep, you know, drawing the analogy with the conventional bubble chamber and this thing all the way through, because there is a strong analogy. It works in exactly the same way. Okay. So what are these magnetic bubbles? What are these magnets? So let me tell you about single molecule magnet crystals. So I'll tell you more about these in the chemistry section. But basically, they're little crystals. so it's some crystal. They have a size of about something like a micron to a millimeter. They can be a bit larger as well, depending on how the chemists grow them. And as it says, each molecule in this crystal acts like a little single magnet. So they act like, so each of these molecules has some spin, and the spin is like a little magnet. So this is molecular size, so like a nanometer or something.
Sorry, the molecule. Excuse me, the molecules are on the sites of that?
That's right. So exactly. These are each of these is supposed to be a molecule, and each of these molecules is acting like a magnet.
What gives you the crystal shape? The same molecules?
So the molecules crystallize in exactly the way that like H2O crystallizes into I. So they have some.
So is this the things on the sites which make the crystals?
Yeah, I'm going to attempt to draw a little chemical diagram in a second. But so the really important thing about these is that each of these magnets that comes with each of these molecules is essentially non-interacting with its neighbors, which is very unusual, actually. In ferromagnet, you have these big domains where all the spins in the domain line up. This essential non-interaction is really important. I'll come to it in a second for the detector. But the Hamiltonian looks something like this. So it's just a sum over I, where I runs over each of the molecules, molecule sites, I guess. And then there's the spin of the molecule J, JZ for each site, squared. And so this is, because of the squared, this is the potential is you can think of it as a double well. So there are, I guess, 2J plus 1 states with plus J here and minus J here. So the minimum energies are plus J and minus J. Okay. So the idea is the following. To use this as a detector, you apply a B field. This aligns spins. Well, spins that are aligned with the B field, say here, they sit in a metastable. The B field gives you a Zeeman energy, so it removes this degeneracy. So you get a higher well and a lower well. These spins are here, sitting in the higher metastable well.
How do you get this by some?
Pick them.
Your first.
If you're happy waiting, I'll address that in like a little while. But yeah, there are different ways of doing it. You can think of them all aligned. I think more usefully, actually, just half of them are aligned. You start in thermal equilibrium, just apply a B field, and half of them are there, half of them are not. There is, of course, a relaxation time. I'll talk about that as well. But so imagine that these just are sitting stably, well, sort of metastably here for long enough to make this a useful detector. Then dark matter comes in, deposits a little bit of energy. So this is dark matter or some particle. As you get a localized heating, this heating is causing these spins to relax. So just in the way that happens in a normal bubble chamber. So you get spin flips. These things flip to the ground state. And they release delta EZ. So this is delta EZ. This gives you more local heating. So you get more heat in this region, which then spreads out, and more spins flip. And so you you start to get this kind of picture, where this region grows and grows, and this is the region in which the spins are flipped. And so this is a flame front that propagates through your crystal. Has interesting propagation, actually. And this is known as a magnetic spin, a magnetic avalanche or whatever. Avalanche.
What theories are we angular momentum?
Magnetic deflagration is actually. Sorry?
What theories are we the angular momentum? Because it's a big change in angular momentum, right? So it's a 2J change in angular momentum when you flip all the spins to the lower side.
Well, so I mean, what do you mean, what carries it away?
I'm just asking about angular momentum conservation.
I mean, it's conserved overall. I guess.
What's happening? So after that,
you can imagine just like this is a collection of just particles with spins, and the spins are going down, and the idea is that you're going to be detecting the change in flux of.
I mean, microphysically, it's all dipole transition.
Yeah, it's all dipole transition.
So they're emitting photons.
Yeah, exactly. It goes to like a heaty photons, yeah, or phonons, I guess, as well. It's phonons and photons. The whole. Yeah, there is like yeah, exactly. It releases the heat, right? Yeah.
But microphysically, there's sort of dipole transition.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of crap is happening in this crystal as this happens. But, like, it's actually the most, I mean, this is beautiful, beautiful EFT, you know, in action. the fact that the Hamiltonian looks like this, and I'm going to draw the UV theory in a second on the board, and it's some complicated, you know, molecular crystal.
And what's the typical energy that you release in the initial, from the upper spillover thing?
This is something like of order, like a sort of an MeV, a milli-EV. Yeah, or slightly less than a milli-EV. It depends. So it depends on the B field. And I'll talk about this. So this is exactly one of the tuning aspects of this detector. So in the same way as you tune a conventional bubble chamber by adjusting the temperature and the pressure, so you sit right on a particular energy threshold. Again, there are parameters in here that you can tune, so you sit exactly on the right threshold. And this is a very important parameter that you tune.
But it's like an MeV for a Tesla external field?
MeV, yeah. So this would correspond to like a 0.1 Tesla or something, yeah. So I should have said that this spin, so the value of this spin can range, well, is let's say 10 to something like 50. So there can be very large spins. And so, yeah, you just have the usual 2 mu BJ splitting. That's about a 0.2 Tesla.
So there's no surface tension term for the bubble?
So I guess if you're interested in describing the dynamics of the bubble, you could probably describe it in terms of like a surface tension. Well, yeah, I guess that's true. So the way that
in the bubble chamber, the surface tension is what gives you the threshold, right?
Yeah. So here, this is the equivalent of the surface tension somehow. Like this Zeeman energy is that. Yeah. So you could probably write a slightly more coarse-grained. Even more direct analogy with the bubble.
I guess the surface tension is actively resisting the growth of a bubble, whereas in here, there's nothing keeping the spins from flipping.
That's right. But if this doesn't pass a certain, if this isn't releasing enough energy, then it doesn't cause the avalanche to occur. So this has to hit a threshold energy. So it's kind of, yeah, I don't know. Okay, I think that's it. Is this detector, you know, in some sense clear where I'm kind of headed with this? So the idea is that you know these spins are going to flip. You're going to detect the change in flux, and this spin flipping is the kind of the amplification of your tiny little energy deposit. Okay. Well, in that case.
Sorry, before we move on, how many targets do you have in mind here? Like how many?
The mass of the detector, you mean? I mean, so you know, I would quote kilograms, and I can talk about the synthesis in a second. But yeah, as much as you can make, right? That's a more experimental question, I suppose.
Because what I'm wondering is, if you could make multiple different regions of this, would it be possible to get them all to have spins oriented in the same direction, or would you?
So you could, if you're happy to sit there with tweezers, I suppose you could orient them, or you could find some more clever way of orienting them, maybe. It's not necessary, because what you end up doing is paying a sort of geometric factor, like a cos, you know, just a cos theta factor. Which sort of somehow gets all tangled up in essentially the tuning of the threshold. So if half of your spins are sort of like sitting, you know, in the wrong way, like perpendicular or something, then they lose like a geometric factor on the threshold tuning. But then you can still, you know, your overall detector. So the way that we are envisaging actually doing this is just taking a powder of these things and just chucking it in and not worrying about the orientation. So you have a little, you know, few millimeter powder sample.
Powder.
At least that's what's happening in the prototype thing. Okay. Any more questions? So, I guess some chemistry. Okay, so actually the first single molecule magnet was synthesized in the 1980s. I think I called Li. But its properties were not realized at the time. So people did not realize it had this extraordinary magnetic, little magnetic non-interacting magnets at each of the sites. And then in the 1990s, they realized this. And since then, now, you know, between the 1990s and today, there have been hundreds of different types of single molecule magnet that have been synthesized. So they all have a very similar broad effective description, but they're all different, the different chemical makeup. So let me just give the one that was first synthesized, which is kind of archetypal one. It's called magnesium acetate. Okay, this is properties realized. I should say there's a number of reasons why people have been excited about these, just, you know, not particle physics reasons. Because if you have a very high density of spins that you can manipulate individually, if they're essentially non-interacting, that sounds kind of interesting from the point of view of either just conventional data storage, computer storage, or quantum computing. I was going to say in a second that the people realize that they show macroscopic quantum behavior, which is always kind of neat. And chemists like synthesizing these things as well. They have interesting chemistry. But so let me now try and draw what a molecule of these things looks like. So there's this magnesium 12 acetate. There's a 12 here because there are 12 magnesium ions, and they're sort of arranged in, I'm not going to draw this very correctly, but there's a kind of crown shape of these magnesium ions, and they're sort of held together by bonds in this sort of crown. And these bonds are actually oxygen bonds. So these are oxygen bonds. These are magnesium ions. What these oxygen bonds do is they mediate like an exchange, a super exchange, exchange interaction. It's the same thing as in helium, the thing that makes the spins of these magnesium ions want to point together in the same direction. So it holds them together rigidly. So in other words, these oxygen bonds, this crown, is bound together in a particular way that all the manganese spins point together to make one rigid spin. J in this case is 10. And then around this crown, there are these acetate ligands. So the acetate is just a bunch of carbons, oxygens, hydrogens. But in general, these will be some kind of organic fluff around this central crown. So all of these, like hundreds of these things that have been synthesized since, all have the same kind of thing. You have some central metallic ions that are held together strongly into this kind of central crownish thing, so the spins all align, and then you have organic fluff around these things. And this fluff is important because it means that when these molecules crystallize into whatever crystal lattice the full crystal takes, they separate these spins, and that's why you get this essentially non-interacting property. And as I said before, so when they crystallize, you get an internal crystal field. And this is obviously very small, but this crystal field is enough to set up an anisotropy, such that these spins, so there's like a plane direction that these spins want to be perpendicular to. And this is why you get this Hamiltonian that looks like Jz squared, some over I, Jzi, I of each site. This Jz squared comes because it either wants to be this way perpendicular to the plane or this way perpendicular to this crystal field plane. And then the sum over I with no interaction terms between I and I plus 1 is because this fluff is separating these things. And so this is the beautiful EFT. And then there is sort of, you know, higher order terms, corrections to this. There's a J to the fourth term. So here B is much less than A. But again, this is still single site, and then much lower down you have interactions between these things.
Are there any things like that, you know, the appropriate analog of a spin orbit coupling is where it's coupling the other loads, kind of the crown or the molecule?
Yeah, so there are all kinds of like tiny little interactions, but they're all suppressed. And so like this very broad Hamiltonian captures very well the important features. So let me draw this state. So this diagram again. So again, you have these kind of states. This anisotropy term here does make these things sort of converge a little closer up there. So they have a little bit of a... So this is 2j plus 1 states. And again, when I'm just drawing the same thing again, but you have a B field, they look like this. So this is B is equal to 0. There's an external B field that's been applied. So here's an interesting thing. This is one of the reasons why people got excited about these things, is because if you plot the hysteresis curve of this, so this is applied field, and this is the magnetization, how many net spins are pointing in the same direction. So you start off here, you apply this field to some strong value so that all the spins are pointing in the same direction as the field, and then you move the spin down. But the hysteresis curve, you know, it stays magnetized, and as this crosses zero, then it starts to drop. But then what you see is you start to see quantized drops. So you see these quantized steps down here, and then, you know, back this this way, right? Okay. And so what's happening at these quantized steps is that as you're lowering this B field, so the spins are sort of sitting in this metastable state, as you lower this B field, every time you get like a level crossing, so what this energy level here aligns with one of the energy levels here, then you get enhanced quantum mechanical tunneling between these two states. And so you get a quick drop in the magnetization, a step drop in the magnetization, and you see these quantized steps line up beautifully with.
So those are still individual molecules slipping?
This is individual. This is exactly. This is. But you're seeing you're plotting the magnetization across the whole sample. So yeah. So individual some fraction of molecules are flipping. You do this in some finite time, of course. But you're not seeing a cascade. This is not a cascade effect. No, that's right. No.
How many steps?
So I guess depends on where you start. So the number of energy levels between the starting point here and the ground state, so somewhere between 1 and j, I suppose.
What's j?
J is the spin. So the j is the, this is, so it depends on the molecule. Here it's 10. Yeah.
Do you have to have them all lined up in order to see this?
Yeah, so when you apply, you know, when you apply the initial B field, you apply it to some strong value, so that the magnetization becomes 1 here, which means, you know, essentially all the spins are aligned. Yeah.
Okay, so it doesn't depend on how you construct the crystal? Like, it's not the... So these things can sort of... I mean, the crystal has them all lined up, does it?
Yeah, so that it's a very regular crystal. So the crystal has, you know, I've been drawing this silly shape, but it really does look like this, and it has, you know, an axis. You can see which axis is the axis that is the z axis, if you like, in this.
But when you prepared the initial sample, like starting at time zero on that curve, at that point the spins are not
50-50, I guess. Yeah.
Well, are they even? I was going to say that they're not even they're not aligned with z.
No. They're that's right.
A smooth curve on the
way.
And then once they're aligned with z, there's a preference to remain aligned, but just to change sign.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
How cold does it have to be?
Sorry?
How cold does it have to be?
It depends again on the crystal. I can't remember like the experiment that this was, but I'm not sure what temperature it is. But it can't be too high because you don't want these things. So it depends how fast you're able to do this measurement. So you want if you can ramp the B field from here to here in 10 seconds, then the relaxation time better be way longer than 10 seconds, and that typically. That typically means like lowish temperatures, like 10, 4, 1 Kelvin or something. These things.
Sorry, can I follow up back on Sam's question? So yeah. The way, at least I just did this picture, was because of the crystal structure and the spin, the net spin is always, there's something that you mean by Z in terms of the crystal, and the net spins are always aligned along Z, but either positive or negative, so the net magnetization of the sample at zero field is zero just because there's equal numbers of...
Just because it's in thermal equilibrium.
But it's not because there's no overall alignment along the Z.
No, that's correct. No, it's just the thermal, it's a statement of thermal equilibrium, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
So at time zero, there's equal numbers with plus 100 meters.
Yeah, so if you make a measurement on a random, you know, on any given molecule, it'll be 50% it will be along the z-axis, 50% it will be.
But what's the distribution of like, you know, J perpendicular?
Yeah.
That would, so I imagine that once you magnetize it fully, that's zero. But, and then when you step down, and when you apply the reverse B field, then it's going to remain zero. But at times, initial time when the thing is just thermalized.
Well, I mean, initial time, you can always measure the, you can choose to measure the angular momentum on any axis that you like, I guess. Initial time, again, it will be 50% along any axis.
It's not that they're all zero.
Yeah. No.
There's a crystal structure.
Yes.
You said there's a defined plane.
Yeah. So the crystal structure must mean that they have the nexus already, right? Yeah.
Then why aren't there steps on the way up?
So this might just be the way that the experiment was done. So I'm drawing a kind of cartoon here. So
like you're annealing that surface or something. Like that surface exists already.
So what there could be, I suppose, is you could get little shallow. But it's a slightly different thing, right? So you're starting off here. I guess you're right. There should be little steps on the way up. But it might, so maybe just the picture that I'm thinking of, maybe in the experiment, they did this very quickly, or, you know, there's something that they want to measure. You're right. I should probably have a little step in the way.
That's fine. But so you've already grown it and yielded it. It's already got it.
One
last question. What magnetic field does it take to saturate?
Something like around certainly less than a Tesla, maybe 0.1 Tesla. Again, it depends on the material. I'm not even sure. I should look up the paper where I got this plot from. I'm just sort of drawing it from memory to just emphasize the steps. But
So when you reverse the magnetic field on the negative x-axis of this plot, shouldn't I expect an avalanche already at some point?
So that depends on the parameters. So it depends on how much energy is being released. And so I guess here that you can see that there has been no avalanche. So you have to if you haven't tuned to that threshold, then you will never see the avalanche. Actually, let me talk a little bit more about. Oh, no, I'm not going to talk about avalanches yet. I'm going to talk about relaxation times, because this also, you know, relaxation times is also important in all of this, because that essentially tells you how quickly you can sort of go between the two minimums and how thermal equilibrium is reached and all that. Okay, so the relaxation time is interesting. So that's the time it takes, so it depends on the B field, so there is a dependence on the B field, tau. But so if I plot 1 over temperature, so this is colder to this side, hotter to the left, and this is about 0.1 Kelvin. So this is a few Kelvin, 10-ish, 20-ish Kelvins. This is log of the relaxation time tau. So at high temperatures, there's an exponential law. So the relaxation time behaves exponentially. And then like at lower temperatures, it falls off polynomial. So here, T is going like, tau is going like temperature to the power of n. And here, tau is going like tau naught e to the u over t, where u is a kind of the energy, this activation energy. So usual kind of exponential. And so at sort of 0.1 Kelvin, this relaxation time here, which tends to some minimum, there's a minimum sort of quantum limit that you know at some point you hit just quantum mechanical tunneling that dominates the relaxation time. But this can be this around here can be order of years. Then when you raise the temperature to something like a few Kelvin, then this relaxation time hits the exponential part of this curve and it can move very quickly. So this can be something of the order 10 to the minus 12 seconds at these temperatures. So this tau zero here is the this is the fastest possible relaxation time. So as you send t to infinity, this turns to tau 0. And so this is the fastest possible. This is a parameter that is determined by the chemistry of these things, and they vary wildly. But this is it's very important that within a small range of temperature, you can go from something that is essentially stable of the order of years to something that is 10 to the minus 12 seconds relaxation time, which is then comparable or faster than the thermal diffusivity of the crystal. And this is an important thing to happen
Because
well, first you need it. You need the things to relax. So in the way that the dark matter comes in, or whatever, the particle comes in and deposits some localized heat, you want the spins to relax before that heat dissipates. And so that requires relaxation time of this order, so something like 10 to the minus 10 seconds, 10 to the minus 11, 10 to the minus 12 seconds. That will mean that the spins will flip before that heat dissipates. So that's more the kind of crucial part. You need this exponential behavior to go from gear, which is also important. This side is also important for you to have a stable detector in the first place, down to something that can work.
But that's the heat dissipation time?
So complicated chemistry. It's I don't think people... This is a measured parameter. So I've given three parameters here. So these are good to keep in mind. So the spin, J of the molecule. There's U, I haven't been writing it in, but U is the activation energy, so the kind of energy barrier here between the plus and the minus J states. Then there is now this parameter tau zero, and these are all sort of chemical parameters, so you can have chemical tuning of these parameters. I'll tell you a little bit how they do this in a second. There's another parameter that's very important, which is B, which is a continuous parameter, so the external magnetic field that you can apply. And these are important parameters to keep in mind, but these are tuning. So these will all affect the kind of the onset of the energy threshold, the onset of the avalanche. So these, as I said already, range from 10 to something like 50-ish. This, in units of Kelvin, is like from a few Kelvin, I don't know, 10 Kelvin-ish, up to thousands of a couple of thousands of Kelvin, maybe 2,000 Kelvin, 3,000 Kelvin, something like that. And this tau zero, the fastest possible relaxation time, ranges from 10 to the minus 6 seconds to about 10 to the minus 14 seconds. And I'm going to be considering, this is just an experimental thing, but sort of 0.1 to 1 Tesla B fields.
For the activation parameter, why is this just custom? Why is it, for instance, a temperature?
Oh, it's just custom. It's also useful because it means that, roughly then, once you deposit this... Once the temperature is raised to this, then the spins will... You have energy enough to get over the barrier. Multiply by 10 to the minus 4, if you like, I guess, to get it back to EV.
So the idea... I mean, but it's that happening at one site, right?
This is a parameter, if you like, of the Hamiltonian... That is defined, this is related to this A parameter, I suppose. Right? It just gives you the height difference between the J is equal to zero state, and the energy difference between the J is equal to zero state and the J is equal to plus or minus J state. It's this energy here.
Yeah, I mean it's a purely local fact.
Yeah.
About the...
Yes, it's a purely local fact about the EFT. And so the way that these are tuned, I still have my thing, yes. The way that people tune these things is kind of interesting. I mean, this is what the chemists like to do. So they change the ions in the middle. They change, in particular, the organic ligands, yes.
What's the energy scale for the splittings between the various J states?
So around the U over J. Tuning these things, changing this molecule by putting in a different little organic compound changes these incredibly changes these parameters of U, tau zero, and then of course changing the internal crown changes J. So like these things are like remarkably fine-tuned. You can just change, you know, a few little ions in the organic part of the molecule, and suddenly, you know, you and tau zero are completely different. So there's some extraordinary fine-tuning going on. And if I were to plot, you know, the 100 or 200 or so, you know, single molecule magnets that have been tabulated so far, like with tau zero and u, ranging from what was it? Like 1,000 down to 10, 10 to minus 6, down to 10 to minus 6, 10 to minus 14 seconds, Kelvin. These things really just sit all over the place. So they sit in kind of like families. So where all the internal ions are the same, so they're all manganese, they all sort of sit in sort of one patch here, and then there's some lanthanides here, and, you know, they sort of sit in like some family. Like spread here, but like really they're all over the place, and so there's a lot to choose from, and they all have different properties as well. Some of these things scintillate, you know, the crystals look different. Some crystals you can grow big, some crystals you can't. Yeah.
Which temperature do you want, and which terminal do you want?
So we want something that's going to be sensitive eventually to like milli electron volt deposits, which kind of suggests a U of around. A milli electron volt, or around, you know, 10-ish Kelvin. Tau zero for us is really important, as I said. You know, this wants to be lower than something like 10 to minus 10, 10 to minus 11 seconds, in order to beat the thermal diffusion of some localized heat deposit. So then that does reduce the number of single molecule magnets that you can look at. J is not so important, but I mean, it's kind of important.
All these dots are, you know, the hundreds of things that were discovered.
That's right. Yeah. So I just took the, you know, I at some point I looked at some. There's actually a review now that you can look at. You know, they literally just tabulate these things. They give the chemical formula, which means very little to me. But then they have in the table there's column for U, J, and tau naught. So it's very beautiful how all these things fall under the same classification. And the synthesis, I should say, the way that they make these things is really, it's sort of, well, firstly, it's very cheap. So if you just take the price of the raw materials, that, you know, to make a kilogram of one particular single molecule magnet, it's going to be like $1,000. It's not. The raw materials are very cheap. Of course, then you have to have a lab, and you have to have, you know, I don't know, a million test tubes to make these things. But really, it does. What you do is you sort of mix these things together. You heat them, you stir them, you let it cool, you decant it, and then you dry it with air. And that is the process that that you go through. It takes time for these things to crystallize inside the little test tubes. And of course, it's, you know, there are some fiddly things that. That Phil has been tinkering with, but yeah, the synthesis side of it is kind of attractive. And I should say, like, you know, another thing about this is that this is Phil's. Phil is he was a grad student at Berkeley in the chemistry department. You know, he's making these things in his lab, and then he's sending them. He's just sent them to RUPAC at Texas A&M. And these things, you know, obviously it's not a pristine environment. He's not creating the most beautiful crystals. There's going to be impurities and all this kind of stuff. The nice thing about this is that this mechanism doesn't require any sort of purity. So this detector is an unusual detector as far as particle detectors go. There are not many that are like it in that it's a bulk detector. So it doesn't require any surface. It's not like the thing is the thing that you're hitting is also the detector. It's not like you have some volume of target material and then you detect things on the edge. And most particle detectors actually are like this, right? And so then you have to worry about how whatever the signal is, whether it be phonons or, you know, scintillation light or you know, how it propagates through this material. And, you know, especially like in dark matter, something like CDMS is very important. That crystals are super pure. There's all kinds of problems with like radioactivity that will obviously play a role here. But just in terms of just pure purity of the crystal, in terms of, you know, getting your signal out, this thing doesn't have to be pure. It can be dirty. And in fact, somehow it, you know, being a dirty crystal might actually be advantageous, because you can you get localized phonon modes, which can help increase your cross section.
So how do you do readout? Like, have you read
that? So the readout is you have a little magnetometer here. So once the magnetic bubble grows large enough, you can pick up the flux change. You know, you pick up this flux change through a pickup loop, like a squid or something.
So how big a crystal?
So these are typically, they're kind of like a micron, up to a millimeter. I have a few slides of them I show. But I mean, if it's like a powder of these things, I guess we're thinking like a micron powder. And so a micron is a nice size, because when a crystal of size micron flips, you can pick that up with a very fancy magnetometer, like a femtotesla per square root hertz squid, in around 10 to the minus 6 seconds. So, and it also takes around 10 to the minus 6 seconds for this thing to burn, and then you can imagine resetting in around another 10 to the minus 6-ish seconds. So that basically a micron-sized crystal you can pick up and detect, and it's a useful size. For
the resetting is the thermal, you raise the temperature.
So the reset mechanism, which I think I was about to talk about, well, I was going to talk about the Energetics Principle, I'll tell you now. So you just turn off the B field. So it's the same thing as like the recompression in a conventional bubble chamber. You turn off the B field, that stops the fuel. The external B field is the fuel for this spin front to continue. So you cut that off. And I say a little bit more about that. There's a couple more details in a second.
Transferred between crystals, or does this thing only ever happen in one crystal?
Yeah, so it will happen in one crystal. If the crystal was like a meter in size, if it's a big crystal, you could turn off the B field before the whole crystal has flipped, because you could detect it and then just turn off the B field, and that would stop the avalanche from happening. Probably more useful would be just to have a crystal of size micron, it just gets to be all flipped. And then you detect that, and you have a power of them. There's a bunch of them suspended in, I don't know, some other fluid, and then then the heat can spread. But you don't want, obviously, you don't want the heat to spread too much between crystals, because you don't want a bunch of crystals all flipping.
Why not?
You want to turn off your B field before that happens, basically. Otherwise, you lose detector. As soon as they've flipped, in some sense, you've lost the detector. But the nice thing about turning off the B field is that then you're back to the thermal equilibrium state. The spins become 50-50 again, and then you just have to wait for it to cool, and then you...
That's only if it's hot enough, right? I mean, if it's very cold and the spins aren't going to flip on their own.
If it's very cold and the spins aren't going to flip on their own, no, you have to, they only flip when the avalanche hits them. Yeah. Well, individual spins may flip because there's just so many of them, and there's a finite probability. But the point is that you want to tune this thing. I'll say a little bit more about this in a second, or these sort of more detectory aspects. I mean, this is my theorist speaking as a... So maybe I'll come back to those questions. So I actually wanted to, while we're on the chemistry, give some hard experimental evidence for these avalanches, because it's kind of a cool experiment that people did. So the avalanche part of this story is not, it's not just fiction, it really does happen. So that's something that people have observed. So let me tell you about how they do that. So avalanche. So this is a PRL 110207, so something from 2013. Okay, so let me see if I get this right. So what they do is they take a... draw this. So this is a single molecule magnet, and they sort of attach one end of it to a heater. Because it's a nice crystal, they know which direction the axis is. They know this is the Z direction, so they align it like this. This is the heater. Then they put down here a bunch of Hall sensors. So Hall sensors. So 1, 2, 3, 4. This is sort of like we're talking about like a millimeter in size here. They have two fields that they can apply, a perpendicular field and a field along the Z direction. So the perpendicular field, what this does is that it affects the activation energy. So they want to be able to tune this separately, this activation energy U here. So this is the purpose of this perpendicular field, but you can sort of forget about it if you like. The Z field, of course, the field in this direction, is the one that gives you the splitting of the degeneracy. Okay, so what do they do? So they start off with this thing with all the spins aligned in this direction. So they prepare the sample beforehand, such that they know that by putting it in a large magnetic field, they know all the spins are in this direction. Then they apply a pulse to this heater. So let me do a cross-section view. So this is the heater here. This is the Z direction. This is the heater. So initially all the spins are aligned like this. As this heat propagates through, what's going to happen is after this pulse is made, these spins are going to flip. So, and this will happen like this. So you have a bunch of spins flipping. These ones haven't flipped yet. So you can imagine like something propagating through the crystal, right? And so what happens, if I draw the field lines here, you know, this part of the crystal, the field lines look like this. This part of the crystal, the field lines look like this. But basically you get a very large flux of field lines coming out of here. And that's what the Hall sensors that measure the field in this direction are picking up. Okay, so this is the x direction, say. So you can plot the field in the x direction against time. So this is in milliseconds. This is the x direction. Okay, so this is what the Hall sensor 1 sees. HZ is equal to 0. So no field applied in the Z direction. And so we're in this situation here. There's no Zeeman. So you don't expect any kind of avalanche because there's no fuel for this avalanche to happen. So Hall sensor 1 sees this around sort of 20 milliseconds here. Hall sensor 2 sees this. Hall sensor 3 sees this. Hall sensor 4 sees something like this. 1, 2, 3, 4. If you compare that to some finite HZ, so HZ does not equal 0, so now they apply the B field. And again, this is time in milliseconds. This is 20, 40, 60, and so on. You see the following thing. You see this is 1 millisecond, 1.2, 1.4, something like this. So much faster time scale. And the difference is this whole sense of 1, 2, 3, 4. So here what you see is, so there are two things. So what's happening here is that you're just getting the heat is just, it's just thermally diffusing down this crystal. And that's what's causing the spins to flip. And you can see this, one, because of the time scale is correct, but also because these peaks are sort of getting further and further apart and then also broadening. So that's what you expect when it's just thermal diffusion of the heat that's causing these things to flip back. In this case, when you have enough of a Z field, you pass the threshold for this avalanche to occur, and you see a very quick propagation. Not as quick as the speed of sound. It has a speed of about a meter per second, so it has its own independent speed within the material. But this flame front then propagates through, and it's sharp. Right? So you see it doesn't spread out as it sort of burns its way through.
Is it temperature locally?
This I think is at point. I think this is at one. This is at 1 Kelvin, yeah.
And this is of order what? This is of order
U. This is of order. I can't remember the value for U. Sorry.
U there is 2,000 Kelvin, right?
Yeah, that's why I'm asking.
No, that is the range of them. So they range from something like 10 to 2,000. My feeling is that this is tens, a lot of 10-ish Kelvin. So the important thing is like how much energy this heat pulse gives and how much magnetic field is applied in this direction. So those two, this heat pulse has to be of order essentially U, and this magnetic field has to be enough such that when it flips down, this is kind of, which it automatically is, sort of order U-ish. And then you see this. Okay, so people observe this, and
do they see spontaneous transitions, or ones generated by background sources of heat, like the cosmic radiation?
So they don't report about that. I mean, so obviously for this to work, you assume that they have some time where they're not seeing these background effects. In fact, this magnetic avalanches was first discovered. It was a nuisance. They were trying to just keep these things stable, and they were seeing these things sort of go off. And then people started to study it a bit more systematically. But there, for this experiment to work, you have to have time when the thing is stable. But of course, that depends on the threshold.
But that wasn't really explored in this paper.
That wasn't explored in this paper. And that kind of thing has not been explored, as far as we're aware.
So the form in which this energy gets introduced is pretty different from what a dark matter particle would do, right?
That's right, yeah. So that's why, I guess, the prototype is important. The prototype is firing neutrons into one of these things. But you expect. I mean, if this works, you expect it's just a local heat. This mechanism is just heat based.
So heat would be deposited by one of these molecules bouncing around.
Yeah. So a neutron or a dark matter, whatever particle hits one of the molecules, it goes into vibrations of this molecule. All the things vibrate, and then at a coarse grained level, that's heat, and then this effective Hamiltonian tells you that you're going to flip.
So you're heating up a single molecule.
So the idea is that you're heating up some little area, dark matter or some particle interaction will be a local heating. It'll heat up a little area, say a few molecules. We don't want to just, a single molecule is slightly problematic, one from the point of view of just the coarse grain description, but also we want to be in a regime where we tune things such that if one spin flips, just because it does, because there are 10 to the 20 spins or whatever in this thing, we don't want that to set off an avalanche. So you want to have enough heat.
How is the heat deposited? There's a
scattering. So just or absorption in like a phonon mode of this of this lattice, for example, or if it's higher energy, it could be just like an electronic transition. You could ionize this thing. It doesn't matter. Eventually, as long as it ends up as heat in a local part of your crystal, then this mechanism works. And this is what I was saying before about how it's not a big deal if it's not pure crystal impurities.
How much energy has to be deposited?
Yeah, so that depends on these tuning parameters. It depends on the activation energy. So roughly of order the activation energy.
What's the separation between sites between
molecules? It's around a nanometer, I guess.
So do you have a critical radius like you do in bubble formation?
That's right, you do. So if you look at our paper, I plotted a bunch of these I call them tuning curves, right? So there's a critical radius for a given U at which this, I have one of my slides actually, at which this occurs. And you can see that then, given higher and higher external B fields, so more and more Zeeman energy being released, you see this tuning curve being pulled down, and eventually it gets pulled down to infinity, and that's the onset of the avalanche, yeah. That's right. So it's exactly the same.
So how big is the critical radius in terms of the size of the molecule?
So, So I guess the way that we think of, well, I was thinking of it is that you take a radius that's a few spins long, so say 3 spins, say 10 nanometers cubed, or so radius of 10 nanometers, and then you can ask for a given U, how much energy, fix these things, and ask, I deposit this amount of energy. Do I get an avalanche or not, and how much B field do I need to actually have that onset of that avalanche?
Yeah. It sounds like if it's 10 units wide, it needs to be a lot more than a unit.
Or three units wide, say. I think it would be 3. So, yeah. But you're right, it needs to be more than U if it's that.
You can change U with B.
But you can also change U with B. It's U, the activation energy is U minus the Zeeman, half the Zeeman split. This is U, this is the activation energy, so it's true, you can also tune the activation energy to some extent. All right, so let me just quickly, I don't know what I want to say about this. So I suppose I've kind of talked a bit about the detector principle already. I'll just go through it one more time, just in an idealized way, this is, again, the theorists in me speaking, but you know, you have some sample, is powdered crystals, each of these crystals is about a micron, you have a pickup loop here, you apply this B field to this. So the idea is that first you take B is equal to zero and you cool your sample. So this is the curve here where this is log of tau, 1 over temperature, this is years. So you cool it so that the relaxation time is years, zero field, so you sit here. Then you apply the B field. This means that half of your spins will be in the metastable well, half of them will not be. So in some sense, half of your detector is active, if you like, in terms of volume. This, I think, is nicer than potentially first applying the B field, then cooling, and then trying to reverse the B field. And trying to get a higher fraction than half, you can imagine doing that just by sort of magnetizing one-way cooling and then flipping the magnetization. I think it's probably not that useful to do that. For a couple of reasons. One, you at any rate lose a bunch of spins when you flip through zero magnetic field. Also, when you turn the B field off, it's nice that your sample is not magnet. There's no self field of the little crystal, which could, you know, you have to tune out in order to cancel the avalanche. Then you have an event. So you have localized heating. This puts you down to here on this curve. And this causes, so this is now 10 to minus 12 seconds. This is local heating. And so this thing relaxes and then you get the avalanche. And then as I said, the reset is just you turn the B field off and now there can be no avalanches because there's no fuel. And you're back to, in some sense, the start.
You let the critical thing load up the entire detector?
So that's the question of like whether, you know, how much dead part, you know, dead volume of the detector you work with, and whether you can, you know, sustain just a few of the crystals being, you know, having flipped and not transfer their heat into other crystals and cause them to flip. That's I guess that's an experimental question.
But you're detecting this with measuring the magnetic field.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah.
I don't understand the length scales here. In the original picture you drew a bunch of crystals. But these are all individual crystals.
These individuals are like, yeah, micrometer in size. So. Yeah. And this is, I don't know, like 10 centimeters. If it was a kilogram detector. Yeah.
So do you detect a single crystal, the entire crystal?
That's right. So if this is 10 centimeters away, then you can detect, once this micrometer crystal has flipped, you can detect that. Using a fancy magnetometer, yeah. That's the idea. Okay, so I guess maybe I'll just say a few words about this prototype that's been built. So I think the first thing is that, you know, I guess where you're kind of coming from with this question is that you first just want to see something, right? So you want to basically, you take a, actually I have some slides, maybe I can show this now. Do I have to turn this on or does it work?
It should be on.
Okay. So yeah. So this is slides taken from Hao. So the idea is that you have a sample, and some you shield this sample, you put it in a fridge. It's a very conceptually simple idea. So you put the powder sample in here. You have a Hall sensor on top of this sample. This is the fridge down here, and then you have a neutron source. And so I think the first thing that to achieve is just to achieve first a stable detector, and then to be able to measure a difference, see a difference between when you do have the neutron source and when you don't have the neutron source. See whether you can really see these avalanches happening or not. So that's the first idea. The B field is around is less than 0.1 tesla. These are just some pictures. This is the shield. There's a fridge. There's a hall sensor. And I just wanted to show you some pictures of the chemicals. So these are the chemicals that that Phil has made for this. So here we're working with an activation energy of something like 70 Kelvin, a much shorter tau zero than you would want to if you wanted to have these things really working at like a millielectron volt detection. Spin is 10. This is the sort of size of the crystal sample. He's getting some nice long, half centimeter crystals actually in this case. But like for this is this tuning curve. So this is the radius of the kind of the local area that needs to be heated, and this is the amount of energy that you need to put in order for the spins to flip. And so you see for a radius of something, this is a much larger scale experiment than the ideal.
That's 10 to the 6 in the middle there?
That's 10 to the, beg your pardon? 6, 10 to the 6. Yes, this is 10 to the 5 EV. So this is a much, much higher threshold than one, than a... But you have a capital MEV neutron source, and you can set this thing off. This will deposit enough energy with one of these scatterings to make this flip.
Do you know what the density of the crystals are?
I think I roughly talk about ice. But those kind of measurements and that kind of detailed analysis, we haven't done. I mean, that would follow, I suppose. Yeah.
So you're not aligning the Z, like, all of you have a collection of crystals with Z quantum.
That's right. And so that should also be modified, so that will give you, as I said, like, just a geometric factor.
Right.
Yeah. So for something like this, you might actually end up getting the same bubble chamber rejection against electrons because of the radius.
That's right, and the other thing is, that's right, yeah. So background, kind of backgrounds are something that I think they fall into two classes. One is like high energy backgrounds, which will look very different. So in this kind of setup, you might imagine, other ways. You work on a veto. So you imagine other ways to veto these kind of events. Also, within this bubble chamber device itself, these events would look different because this thing comes in and ionizes everything, or you get a track in some sense, like in a bubble chamber. Of course, the low energy backgrounds, goodness knows what, radioactivity, all this kind of stuff. But I guess if this works, if you can show a difference between when you do have a neutron source and when you don't have a neutron source, that in itself I think will be kind of really exciting. This in principle is actually a particle detector. You detect particles. So I guess there's new results in the summerish. Sorry?
Are they just using Californium or Long Beach? What the actual
source is? I'm not sure what the source is. No, I can look that up though. I have it.
It's a PAX source or something.
It's not a gun.
It's not a gun.
It's just I think they did have a gun, but they had to dismantle it just before they started working on this project.
Anyway, so if you want
100
keV,
it'd be
close.
Yeah. All right, let's stop there.
Do you know how to calibrate it?
Well, a gun would be good for that, I suppose.
Well, not if you're trying to get down to 70
keV. But, yeah, I mean...
I just have no idea.
So you could imagine using heat sources. That could be one potential way.
That's very
challenging. I'm sure it is. Yeah, I know.
You mentioned X-rays earlier, something which could.
You could use particles that you know the energy of very well.
So they
have those in the paper for the case of a dark photon. So there's some interesting things here. So one, it's kind of difficult to make the projections in some sense, because this is a messy material. So the reason why things like superfluid helium or germanium crystals are nice is because you can model them theoretically really well, and so you can sort of do that exercise of you have a scattering event and then what's the cross section. For these things, they're a complete mess. You don't know how to describe that scattering event. What you do know how to describe though is the absorption, because there are spectroscopy published data on these crystals, so you can you know what it is for photons, and then you know what it is for dark photons. So absorption, you can get good ideas. So scattering is more interesting, and as I say, like the phonon description of these things, they're a very disordered system. You have all kinds of crazy stuff going on. You have these localization of phonon modes, and as I say, like what's nice about this is that I think it actually helps you. So one of the issues of scattering off something like germanium or silicon is that there's a very tight dispersion curve that you have to live on. So if your energy and momentum don't quite match up, which you know they might not for light dark matter, then you're off the dispersion curve, and you have to scatter into two of these things, two phonons, in order to get back onto the dispersion curve. And that then you pay a phase-based price. Whereas here, because it's completely disordered, what happens is the dispersion curve just spreads. And so that's, you potentially don't have to pay that phase-based factor. So I think impurities are good for increasing cross-sections, but they're bad for calculations. But they're also interesting for calculations. Localization of phonon modes is amazing. I don't know if you ever took, like, you can do it in Mathematica very quickly. You just put 100 oscillators in a line together and make their masses random and just diagonalize that Hamiltonian and see what happens to the normal modes that come out. And it's amazing. Like, they localize to a few of the top sort of like 10 or 20 modes of these things will be just localized to just a few of them moving at one point. I was astonished when I did this, but that's really what happens.
In the case of absorption in the line, what bandwidth do you have? Don't you have? Aren't you restricted to the energy gap?
The energy gaps of so the absorption of these things, of course, the absorption of light in one of these crystals is very, very complicated. There's all kinds of things that hit you. As you go down in energy, you move through like electronic transitions of single ions, and there's also like electrons can move around in the full molecules. You have all these kind of like weird bumps all over each other. And then you get into the phonon modes, and these are complicated structures, and they have a million different phonon modes, and it all overlaps. But there are some that you can see, like you can see peaks of like a carbon oxygen bond. All this kind of thing. So the spectra are somewhat understandable, and people, chemists in particular, do spend time understanding this. It's interesting. Yeah.
Is it possible to discriminate between different avalanches, maybe? And therefore...
In what sense?
Does every avalanche look the same?
It does, because it very quickly it gets dominated by the avalanche itself. So somehow, once you set it off, anything about what initially set it off is quickly dominated. You just lose it because your energy just becomes essentially the energy that's released by the avalanche.
So you can't measure energy other than by kind of tuning.
That's right.
That's threshold.
That's right. You just have a threshold.
Right.
Yeah, you lose sensitivity to the energy. You integrate everything.
What does it? MeV cosmic relic neutrino.
The cross section is too tiny. The cross section is.
That a coherent plane distinct, right? It's not coherent.
This is not coherent either, is it? Coherent, yeah.
And also you don't have a local number. So the number of targets is really small in your case, right?
Well, that's part of this problem of like how to model this. I don't know. I mean, I would call every single ion a target, right? Every electron a target.
Why is it not coherent just off the crystal?
I don't know if it can.
Because the process in the scattering on one thingy, the process is exothermic in just an MeV or milli electron volt, right? So the scattering cross section is tiny because it's just going to it's proportional to the neutrino mass.
I know all the things about the regime small.
I think you're right. I think you get coherent. You could be in the regime where you're coherent across all the in the crystal.
Populating, an MeV scatter. That's you're populating sort of, a higher velocity, a higher part of the distribution of cosmic neutrinos, but it's still coherent on the sort of millimeter scale that you have.
That's right.
So the scales line up.
Yes.
Okay, I'm sure the rate's
still... At some point I checked that and it was way too small. Yeah, that's right, but the rate is...
Milli EV, I mean, the cosmic microwave photons times, 4/11 to the...
Well, but no, I mean, the ones in the halo, presumably the ones that you'd like to scatter off over the ones that have clumped, so that you get the over-density enhancement, but those are non-relativistic.
Yes, yeah,
and they're just mass times
velocity. Yeah, yeah, that's, and so I'm saying you're getting some off the tail of that to be the threshold of this.
Sure. Yeah, that's right. I did check, like a while ago, I checked that, and I remember it being way, way, way super small, but maybe it's worth checking again.
The size of your crystal lines up with the coherence length of these sort of MUV.
That's right, so then it's interesting.
But that energy wouldn't be deposited locally.
Yeah, no, you would hit the whole crystal, and then you'd ask how you accept the spins, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, so I guess that energy deposit would not be enough to set off this. If you want to go for the full,
That is a question really for anything, any of the dark matter. Anytime you're going to use the bottom end of your spectrum, anytime you're going to use little MEV scattering, then typically that some non-relativistic object that's changing that momentum is going to be coherent over your entire crystal.
But that's not what. So this requires the local scattering, so it's a non-coherent. Yeah.
I'm saying that there are many situations where that suddenly becomes irrelevant.
Yeah, that's right. I feel that this would not set this off. Because
I'm assuming that the energy deposition is MEV, so I'm assuming it's whatever.
Oh, heavy.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
fine. It's not going to be dark matter, obviously, because it's sub-AV, it's just sort of an interesting case.
Yeah.
You're just saying the debris rate, like, associated with that is always going to be bigger.
The momentum exchange times the size of the object is one, right?
I guess this just doesn't have this wouldn't set off the avalanche. Yeah. The detection would not work in its way.
Okay, and I'm sorry, I have a question. Can a dark matter interact with a single atom though, if the momentum exchange is that small?
There's always an incoherent piece here.
You're just not getting coherent.
Yeah.
We have to flip the whole crystal.
I don't know. The coherent interaction is actually just exciting coherent. It's exciting some phonon modes of the crystal, and then the phonon modes are the one that flips the ones. It would be really cool, of course, if something came in and flipped all the circuits at once.
So that's another possibility of something that has a spin interaction. That is interesting, especially if it's coherent. That would be amazing. But then maybe you don't need the avalanche to detect this, right? You just need something more like an NMR type spin flip.
Isn't the possibility of taking a sample that's sufficiently large and getting all of the magnetizations of each of the individual ones to point in the same direction and then align the magnetization vector with the WIMP wind and then flip that and then look for modulation signals? I can imagine.
I haven't thought about this. So why do you want to align it with the WIMP wind?
I could imagine situations where
if it's interacting by the spin.
For a spin dependent.
For spin dependent, then that would, yes, that would be that would work. Yeah, I haven't thought about it. It's a good idea.
All right. Well, we've got a lot of questions. Any other questions for Tom? Otherwise, let's thank him for a great.